Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed. This is your Toward Justice Weekly, and I'm joined, as always, with my colleague, Colin. Hey, Colin, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm good. I am super excited today because we kind of have a homecoming today. The prodigal son returns home. I am so excited. And I think we have had this request from so many listeners. When will she be back? She is back. Susan Simpson is joining us today. Hey, Susan.
Hey, guys. Hey. And look what I dug out of my laundry to wear today.
She's wearing the gear. Oh, my God. I don't even have one of those. We tried a little bit of a merch drop earlier this year, and I got one of those. But I don't know. I love the quality and the designs that we had before. But anyway, how are you doing, Susan?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
We're hanging in there.
Yeah.
Hanging in there since the relaunch. We're moving along week by week. However, in the last few years, have done some incredible work. I think, Colin, this is like during the time that we were off air, and you started your own show, which has just been incredible and has gotten so much critical acclaim. So we want to talk about just what you've been up to and this specific season. Can you tell us how you've been up to a lot, even outside the show, right?
It's been busy, but the current season of Proof actually goes back to season 5 of Undisclosed.
Yeah.
It's kind of where it started. And COVID.
Yeah. So I'm going to set up a little bit of like the case, and then I want you to kind of take us through. You're up to 6 episodes have dropped so far, but 2 of them are like the sidebar episodes with conversation. And I messaged Susan as like 10 minutes or 15 minutes into the first episode because it is a gut punch right out of the gate. So this case is about the 1988 murder of an 83-year-old man in Kalamazoo, Michigan, bike shop owner. His name is Earl O'Byrne. And he, you know, was a fixture in the community, and the case went cold for a long time. But then 13 years after his killing, a man by the name of Scott Baldwin was arrested. And so I'm going to turn it over to you, Susan. Tell us first about how this case came to you.
Yeah. So if you listen to season 5 of Undisclosed, Jeff Titus's case, that's where we went to Kalamazoo for the first time, learned about the cold case team there. And learned a lot about deer hunting along the way.
Yeah.
Jeff Titus, for those who have not seen the update, was exonerated in 2023. He came home.
Yes.
He is living his best Jeff life out in Michigan now.
That's amazing to hear.
And, you know, after working on Jeff's case, I mean, there's a lot that we learned along the way that kind of always nagged at me and kind of always back of my head. Like, it was something unfinished, in a way. Mm. And, of course, the team Red Marble had the TV show about Jeff's case. And through that, we got in touch with this guy named Scott Baldwin. He knew Jeff in prison. He had been convicted by the same prosecutor. But they knew each other there. And, like, Jeff would be like, hey, my buddy Scott says, like, here's what happened to him. So we started talking to Scott a few years back. We ended up not being able to do his case right away, which we'll get more into later in the season. But as we started working on Scott's case finally last year, we realized that this really is about the cold case team as a whole. And that's the group of detectives that put 21 people in all charged with murders, cold case murders from Kalamazoo. And actually part of it, like a big issue in the cases we're looking at, it kind of all started with Rabia and I, one of our interviews up in Kalamazoo. And it was probably one of the stranger interviews of my life. I don't know about you, but it'll come out more in the season about what we learned that day.
Well, when I hear the episode, maybe it'll come back to me. Right now, I'm like, I was in Kalamazoo. That's how old I am now, Susan. But you connected with Scott through Jeff, and then you began looking into this case. And, you know, I'm just going to put it out there because it's like it's the first couple minutes of the episode is that Scott does come home, but he's very sick towards the end of his incarceration.
Yeah.
And then he passes away shortly thereafter. Just, I think, what, days after his release?
He died two and a half days later, basically.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
We were, we ended up being like hospice care for him the last 2 days because things weren't in place and it was not what we were planning to do. I mean, it was not how any of us was to go down. I have to imagine he held on just long enough to make it home, and he had nothing left to give because...
Oh, my God.
And he declined fat. Like, I don't know. Obviously, when he got out, we weren't thinking like this is it. Like, we knew he was not going to.
I mean, the audio of him was not great, right, even from the day of the release.
And he just had such quick at the end. It went very fast, and it was.
I think you're right. He probably was hanging on until, because that's not uncommon for folks at that stage, that they'll just hang on until something. They're waiting for something. This happened when? Last year?
October, yeah.
October, okay. But you decided to go forward with the season. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why you decided to do the case anyways?
Well, one, like, Scott still, Scott knew at the end that he was not going to be around for the season to start. And he still wanted to go forward. He still wanted to be proven. He wanted to be here to see it, but he wanted to keep going. And of course, along the way, working on his case, we discovered the other Kalamazoo cold cases. And so this is not finished. It's not just about clearing Scott's name, which would be nice, but that's not the main goal here anymore. I wish we could have helped Scott. We couldn't get there in time. But there may be several others who are in the same place, same position he is.
Yeah.
So,
Just for our listeners, you know, Scott was not released because he was exonerated. He was released because of a sentence modification.
Yes, resentencing. We'll get into that more later in the season. Okay. But it was, kind of lucky in a way for someone who never got lucky at all that he did end up coming home, but it was not because of innocence. The system there has rejected every single time he's appealed or had a post-conviction and is unsympathetic in general to his claims of innocence, despite the fact there's quite a lot wrong going on in his case.
You've only aired a few episodes, although by the time this airs, a few more episodes will have come out. So can you lay out the details of, number one, what happened to the victim and how did they get to Scott?
Yeah, so Earl O'Byrne, he was sort of an icon in Kalamazoo. He owned this bike shop that had been there forever, since the turn of the century almost. And it was a very unique place. It was, he lived at the bike shop in a house attached to it. And it was kind of a cluttered hoarder mess.
Really interesting character.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not a lovable victim, but
yeah.
Did not light up a room. Yeah.
No. But his brother Johnny, actually, people do say he lit up the room. And they're like, then there's Earl. But he was found one morning. His employees get to work, open the shop, try to come in and find him dead in the place where he slept. And he'd been beaten to death overnight. And they believe for a long time it's a robbery, but they can't solve it. They have lots of people call in clues and just it doesn't go anywhere.
And it's a bit of a weird locked door mystery in a way.
Yeah.
Right? It is sort of, to me, it's something that the investigator should have really focused on immediately and never did, because the doors were all locked when they got there. Mm-hmm. And they just decide that Earl O'Byrne locked the shop up himself, but
after he was attacked. Yeah.
Yes, and very brutally. Well, actually, not even. So the other thing, too, is the attack on him. He was beaten in the head, but he died from lacerations, blood loss.
So it was possible that he could have been attacked. Attacker leaves. He locks up.
I guess. Yeah. It's possible, but there's, as we'll get into, there's reason to question that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the blood trails don't seem to support. It seems more like some, I don't know. Well, there's definitely a mystery there. At the very least, it's an odd thing they should have tried to figure out. Also, he is seen outside the bike shop before he's killed at middle of the night with a unidentified blonde man. Mm. Fast forward to 2000, cold case team decides to take on the bike shop case.
Was there a robbery? I can't remember that.
Turns out that there was not a robbery. The story back at the time was that these cash bags and these boxes of coins were stolen. And that's the evidence used to corroborate the case against Scott, is that he had the bank bags and the boxes of coins. Yeah. Turns out they were not stolen. The bank bags were in the photos, just somehow overlooked.
Oh, my God.
I don't know how. Yeah, they're right there. And there's this whole thing where the prosecutor's like, how could Stacy, the girlfriend, know that the green bank bag was stolen unless Scott brought it home to her? Well, it wasn't stolen. It's still there. So how does she know?
So let's get to Stacy. Who is Stacy and what is Scott's connection to all this?
Stacy is his girlfriend at the time of the murder, ex-girlfriend for a very long time, at the time of the cold case. Shortly after they broke up for the final time, she goes to the police and says, I think my ex-boyfriend Scott did it. He came in bloody and then he confessed to it. And the cops at the time do not believe her. They just full on do not believe a word she's saying, think she's making it up. Make it very apparent in their reports. And consequently, they don't actually investigate what she says, which is unfortunate, because if they had...
This is many years after the murder. This is not one year.
This is 1 year when she comes forward.
Oh, this is 1 year after the murder. Mm-hmm. Okay, excuse me. Sorry. Okay.
So she comes forward pretty relatively quick. 1 year compared to the cold case. But if they had investigated her, what she said then, we'd know a lot more. And I think Scott would not have died in prison almost. Yeah. But they don't. They just say, okay, this lady's not telling the truth. Let's move on.
Yeah. I wonder, Susan, in terms of your own analysis, I know there are reasons you lay out in the podcast that she might have had a reason to falsely implicate him in the crime. But there's also this detail of him throwing this quote-unquote bloody chair leg, which maybe turns out to be a pain stick, into the neighbor's yard. And I wonder, my immediate thought was, even separate and apart from any vendetta, maybe she sees this and in her head she thinks that's the bloody murder weapon. Mm. And she creates this story that he confessed. But I don't know, that was my own thought process. I don't know if you had a similar train of thought or a different train of thought.
I think that's part of it. I think for sure. Yeah. Did y'all see my Facebook or Instagram post with the Bondo stick?
An actual image of the bot.
I did it myself. I just put some Bondo on the stick.
You did an experiment yourself.
Right. Yeah, so I'll run now and go look at Susan's Instagram. Yeah.
It looks a lot like blood. Like, it actually, reasonably would be seen as blood. It's clearly not paint. So if you see it, you're like, well, that's not paint. What is this, like, very thick? Anyway, once you see the Bondo on a stick, you're like, okay, I could see how someone can mistake it. I think that is the origin of a lot of this. I think Stacy and her friend Missy may have seen this, jumped to conclusions. There's also a tendency by Stacy to, like, sort of create drama. Mm. In the records, you can see she'll take a story and, like, run with it and, like, exaggerate things in a very dramatic fashion. So I think this was kind of an offshoot of that. Like, it started off with her saying, oh my God, I think he really had blood in the stick. And then it went from there.
Do we know if Stacy at the time, was she using, did she have any kind of mental health?
She was heavily.
Yeah, that could have also kind of clouded her judgment and her ability to make sense of what she did see or know. And Scott at the time, I mean, like, you know, it's quite a heck of a leap to be like, I mean, did he have any kind of violent history, any kind of criminal record?
Criminal, yes. He did go out, he was known for, like, stealing out of cars. He would go and, like, you know, grab someone's, like, radio or something, or some, you know, see some coins inside the dashboard, he'll grab them and go. So he was not doing good things at the time. But no, everyone agrees, no, like, drug issues. Like, some drinking, like, pot once or twice is the most they could find. But, like, they try and imply at trial as, like, a drug-fueled, like, need money for that. Mm. But everyone agrees, no drugs. His girlfriend did have a developing cocaine addiction that she hid from him, but Scott was not involved in that.
A year after the murder, when Stacy came forward for the first time, was there a reward offered?
Okay. $75,000.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money in 1989.
Yeah, 19 is a lot of money. But they dismiss her. She doesn't get the money. Then what happens?
Well, they dismiss her, too, because she fails a polygraph, which is not a good reason to dismiss her. So it's like, okay, well.
Yeah.
And she changes her story a bunch right then and there. And she tells some things that are like, okay, that's not very plausible. So I get why they didn't believe her. I wish they'd look more into it. Mm-hmm. But then fast forward to 2000, the cold case team reopens it. They look at reports and they notice that Stacy mentions that Scott has a, like, an Arm & Hammer cardboard box of coins. And they're like, we know that Earl O'Byrne kept his coins in a box of soup box. That's kind of similar. Like, that seems like a key detail, right?
Right.
So based on that, they're like, let's go look into it again. And they go talk to her and she comes across to them as very credible. Like, she does not come off someone who's, like, has a grudge or is vindictive or is doing something for nefarious reasons. She just seems like a, like, here I am and here's my story.
Yeah, 11, 12 years on. Yeah. She's sticking to her story.
She's sticking to a story. Okay. I wouldn't say it's the same story.
Enough. Okay.
But yeah, you know, it's like she's this narrative. She says the same general basic idea story that she did in 1989. And they believe her and they arrest Scott.
Yeah. As undisclosed listeners know, I wear many hats. Law professor, blog editor, podcast co-host, and then there's all the consulting work I do on legal cases across the country. It's a lot of legal work, and it's a lot of business work. But after burning the candle at both ends, I just don't have the bandwidth to deal with the business side of it all. And that's where Gusto comes into play to help me out. Gusto is online payroll and benefit software built for small businesses. It's all-in-one, remote-friendly, and incredibly easy to use. So you can pay, hire, onboard, and support your team from anywhere. You can save time with automated tools built right in. Offer letters, onboarding materials, direct deposit, and more. It's quick and simple to switch to Gusto. Just transfer your existing data to get up and running fast. Plus, don't pay a cent until you run your first payroll. Try Gusto today at gusto.com/justice and get 3 months free when you run your first payroll. That's 3 months free of payroll at gusto.com/justice. One more time, gusto.com/justice. And this is the cold case team, which was also in the Jeff Titus case. And you have this, I would say, an astonishing statistic in the podcast that on average, 25 to 30% of murder cases go to trial.
Yeah.
Whereas 76% of these cases handled by the Kalamazoo cold case team go to trial. And a lot of the series is not just this case. You look into a lot of these other cases that they handled, and Rich Madison is also this important player, right? And so can you remind our listeners, Rich Madison, his role in the Jeff Titus case, and then talking to him about this case?
Yeah, Rich Madison was a detective we talked to for Undisclosed. He actually got kicked off the Titus case because he did not believe Titus had done it. He thought they were going the wrong way. He didn't like the way they were developing witness statements to fit their case. So he spoke out and got kicked off of it. And in general, I'm not going to say he didn't make mistakes, because obviously we wouldn't be doing the show if we did without that. But like, he's, as he told us, like, I'm not bullshitting you. And he's never bullshit us. Like, he has always been forthright and told us, like, here's what I know. Here's what I did. He stands by his work. And obviously he thinks that he got the Scott Baldwin case right.
He does. He does. That's right.
But he was still willing to talk to us. And like, you know, like, he doesn't want to, he's not trying to hide anything. But yeah, Colin, when the 76% stat like blew me away when I did the math. I'm like, that I've never seen that for, I don't think ever for.
And you noted that all of them ended in at least one conviction. And so there's the possibility that we have a lot of wrongful convictions here, including there's another one that Rich Madison notes to you on the podcast, right? Like, I think
Corky Lard. Yeah.
Yeah. Got the wrong guy in that case, too.
Is this going to be proof season 5, 6, 7, 8? And is that
hope to God not?
Yeah.
Well, I
yeah.
mean, it's part of the effort, too, is that, like, to explain to everyone involved in the system in Michigan, like, here's why a reexamination of all these cases is necessary.
Yeah.
There
yeah.
are a lot of them. A lot of them are still alive. Given how old these cases are, like, it's almost shocking how many are still around.
Yeah.
But, you know, Susan or Colin, between the two, can one of you explain kind of the significance to our listeners of why this is a shocking statistic? Why this doesn't make sense? What does this indicate, basically? That why are people going to trial? And also, but what are they offered pleas? That's the other question. What if they weren't even offered pleas?
They were offered pleas.
All of them.
I don't know if all of them, but a lot of them were.
Okay.
A ton of them were. Most of them didn't take it. Corky did, but he got 7 years, so he basically made the right choice there.
Yeah.
I mean, 76% of cases going to trial indicates that, like, one, they're weak cases. Like, the attorneys are like, you know what? We've got a shot at this. It's worth doing it. Like,
the defense counsel,
Yeah. Like, the cases look beatable. They look weak. And two, a strong chance that you have people who are innocent that are not understanding the stakes against them. And whether the cases are strong or not strong, they're going to go for it.
Right. Yeah. They want to prove their innocence.
Yeah.
Let me ask this. You know, Ravia set this up earlier as a locked room mystery. And that's kind of in two senses. The first being that it was locked, the bike shop, when the police came. But also, at the time this crime was committed, the bike shop would have been locked. And I know there's discussion on the podcast about Earl being the type of person who would not let a stranger in, which limits the pool of suspects because it must have been someone he let in. And I wonder, Susan, you know, in terms of the way your brain works and everything, are you completely on board with that? There's no way that Earl lets a stranger in. This has to be someone who knows him. Or do you think there's a possibility it could be someone else who committed this crime?
I think that there's no possibility that Earl goes outside to hang out with someone he doesn't know. So whoever he's
seen with. At night.
Yeah. I mean, could something else have happened after? Yes. Like, that's not impossible.
Yeah.
But then there's the question of why that person he's with never comes forward. I think it's possible in some weird scenario, something happens, maybe he'd open the door, but not like walk outside, not be casually, like, there's no emergency when he's seen. He's just kind of sitting there like this, like, yep. So like, there's nothing urgent.
Right.
Is there one witness to that, or were there two witnesses to that? That Earl was seen outside his shop with somebody.
Two people see him outside the shop. Only one sees the blonde man. So from the sequence, it seems like when the first witness gets there, Earl's in the door. The blonde man's walking around the building. Like a minute or two later, a second witness drives by. Earl has moved out of the door. He's now standing on like the street looking up towards the man that they can't be seen anymore.
Yeah.
So the man's walked behind the building, which is another part that's like bugged me a lot. Like from the very start, I'm like, why is no one asking why this man's walking behind the building? Like there's literally nothing there. There's no reason for him to go there.
Just the act of, I imagine like any of us, like if we're in our door, we don't want to let somebody in. If I feel a little bit threatened, I probably would step a little bit further out to be like, did they actually leave or not? You know what I mean?
Like, well, the car's there. The guy's car is right there though. So he knows he's coming back. Like the guy's car is next parked next to Earl, door open, headlights on. So you know that dude's coming back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe he waited long enough for him to come back. Like, the cars driving by don't know how long Earl was outside.
No, no. But it very much indicates he's not, like, distressed. He's not been tricked. Like, he's going out to see someone he knows.
Mm.
And if we are sticking with the thread of, okay, let's assume this is someone that Earl knows, whom he lets into the shop. In episode 4, I believe, you relay this tip that was received and not initially disclosed during discovery. And involves this teenager who had worked for Earl. And so I wonder, is that the end of it? Or are we going to hear more about this tip and this teenager later in the season?
Yeah, the bloody wrench comes back.
Okay.
The bloody wrench comes back in a way I did not expect.
Interesting.
Oh, that's exciting to hear.
So Colin, we'll get into this more later in the show as well. But like,
yeah,
the crazy thing to me is those Asylum Observer tips, like the tip line tips they have.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. So apparently Michigan has this belief that if they're anonymous tips, they're somehow immune to Brady.
Right.
Which is insane. They don't put it in those words, but they say, like, oh, you don't have to disclose anonymous tips. On the one hand, look, they're anonymous. You can't see who, like, the tip doesn't say who it's from. So who are you even, like, exposing here? Mm-hmm. And two, that doesn't matter. If the state has it and it's evidence that's exculpatory, like, there is no sort of, like, hometown case law. Like,
no.
But Michigan does not play that way. That's going to come back later because it turns out there were a lot of tips in there that were super important that no one ever looked at.
Is that still how they operate today? Or is that like back in the good old days?
I mean, he was still being denied like a post-conviction proceedings in like the 2010s based on this idea. So yeah, apparently they still think it's a thing.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one. Download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Okay, I had a couple more questions about Stacy. So with Stacy, you know, her story kept changing. They didn't believe her. But there was a couple things that drew their attention to her a decade or so later. One was not just that this stick, right? But then there's also like, she did talk about these bags, money bags, which you say actually were at the crime scene. How would she have even known? You know what I mean? Like, that's an interesting detail, unless it came from somewhere else. And the third thing is, the confession. So, Colin, the reason I say this is because I felt like you're kind of giving Stacy a little bit of an opening. You're like, well, maybe she saw that the stick and, you know,
yeah, maybe
got
the story
confused.
Could have started there. But...
It could have started there, but the confession, unless it actually happened, is something completely fabricated.
So the confession is part of her initial story. That's like the one consistent detail she has. It's like she always says he confessed to her. No details. Just like he said, I did it. I killed the old man. Mm. Zero more details. For the bank bag, like, there is literally only one way she could have known that, and that's if the cold case team told her.
Right.
The color.
Right.
So that's pretty obvious what happened there.
Yeah. And by the way, if we didn't mention this, Scott had worked for the victim.
Right.
Like, years
ago. He was 14. We're not sure the exact year, so he was either 14 or 15 at the time, but, like, he was just a kid, and it was not long. It was not a situation where they were, like, you know, my old boss or anything. Like, it was a brief.
And he didn't keep a connection with him. He didn't stay in touch with him. Like... Yeah, okay, kind of a stretch. All right, so was the entire conviction based on Stacy's testimony?
Primarily. There's a couple witnesses kind of support some of Stacy's story. Mm. There was also the fact he really liked this song called Butterfly that they believed was his, like, way of confessing to the murder.
What?
Mm. Yeah, because the lyrics are kind of, it's like some, like, goth metal, I don't know. It's not.
Oh.
And it talks about, like, seeing blood and, like, not being able to clean your hands clean or feeling
it's
dirty.
It's giving West Memphis,
right.
Is what it's given.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of dirty hands and the whole, you know, sort of Lady Macbeth of it all, you note in the podcast, episode one, I think, that there is DNA found on both of Earl's hands, I think under the fingernails, and it excludes both Earl as well as Scott as the source. But you say that's not enough for his conviction to be reversed. And so, you know, was there an opinion by like the Court of Appeals of Michigan or the state Supreme Court? Why was this not enough to overturn the conviction?
It never got that far.
Oh, never even got that far.
He did not have attorneys that were going to bring it to court once the prosecutor looked at it and didn't think it was enough because they don't know who it is. And it wasn't, the profile was not strong enough to go to CODIS, so you can't use that.
Mm. And his counsel didn't think it was still worth the fight?
Well,
of the appellate courts.
Are
you
going
to get to that later?
Yeah,
okay, it's complicated.
It's about the group that Scott was working with, not Scott's claims, actually.
Okay.
It was a group that does not litigate, so they...
This is a really interesting question. I'm not sure I've ever heard this addressed, but I mean, there's this statewide conviction review unit in Michigan. Obviously, the courts don't adjudicate innocence claims by deceased individuals who are released, but I mean, have you approached, or has anyone approached the CIU and thought, okay, if this isn't done in the courts, I mean, do you think the conviction review unit would be a good place to take this case? Would they even hear it?
They were looking at it for many years.
Okay, they were
the ones working on it, and they for them the DNA was not enough.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they couldn't exclude the possibility that Scott had an accomplice, or that it was just, you know, he's not a very clean man. Earl O'Byrne was not, so maybe it was just chance. The same guy's DNA is under his fingers. I mean, it's not impossible. I think they may have misanalyzed some of the evidence. I'm not sure they ever realized there was never a robbery in the first place.
Do we know if that DNA has been run through the system or compared
it's not enough of it. It's too small.
Enough of it to do a full comparison. Okay.
When was it tested? How long ago was it tested?
2024.
Oh, that was pretty recent.
Yeah. So he was really hoping that he could,
Well, let me ask you this. You brought it up about kind of like his appellate counsel. What about trial counsel for him? Could they have done better here? What were the defense failures that there have to have been, right, that led to this?
Well, that's episode five.
Okay. So we'll hold on. Or you can talk a little bit about it.
I will summarize. I'm not even summarizing. Here's like a recap of the entire opening statement. It is now our turn to speak. We're going to call some witnesses, call some detectives. You're going to hear some evidence, and then we'll be done.
Oh, okay. Well, that sets the scene for what comes next.
That's why it took 48 minutes for the jury to return a verdict in the case.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah, the prosecutor asked him to take 15 minutes. So it took longer than that, at least.
That is shocking.
Yeah. There were definite failures.
So in episode four, which Gina just wrapped up, you speak to a judge who I think was he a former prosecutor?
Judge Jaguar was now the chief judge in Kalamazoo, but in 2004.
He was defense attorney.
He was defense.
Yeah. And he brings up a case, Roberta DeVonzo.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Colin, I'm curious if you've ever heard a case like this before. Someone convicted of a hitman murder. The hitman, the guy who does the actual killing, is never identified or even, like, suggested. Just a total blank. Like, he hired someone unknown, don't know how, don't know who, don't know anything about the who did it, but he hired someone and get a conviction on that.
In this case, by the way, at the time the victim was murdered, the defendant was in prison. He was incarcerated. Yeah. So the entire theory of the case is that he hired somebody, except there's a nobody. They didn't even try to identify him, right?
Yeah, well, they did. So from the files, they had some, like, they're like, we should probably try to find a hitman. Couldn't find a hitman. So, like, we don't need that part.
Right.
And also, this case at trial, the only evidence was jailhouse informants. That was the entirety of their case was jailhouse informants. Which I,
And a recanted confession.
Well, the confession didn't get in because
it never got in. Okay.
It was deemed involuntary. It was like back when it happened, he was found.
Well, that's a relief.
Coerced.
Okay.
Yeah. So that couldn't come in. And all the jury heard is that some inmates with him in prison said that he confessed at some point or another, but not like they all heard different versions of a confession. Like none of them agreed on why he did this. There's no evidence he had a motive for it.
Right.
But yeah. So the hitman just. Who cares about that detail?
And so what's going on in that case?
Nothing right now. I mean, except for the Polderman case that we'll get into, none of these defendants have any active claims. None of them have any attorneys. None of them have any support. They've all been forgotten.
Yeah.
Michigan has an innocence.
It does, but they're very, I mean, they're all busy.
Inundated, and
some have written to them, but never. Yeah. It's hard to get help, even if you're in need of it. And also, like, a lot of these cases are ones that are like, not the easy pickings, like not the low hanging fruit, so to speak.
Yeah.
I mean, look, undisclosed listeners, I think, are used to hearing cases in which the prosecution has a theory, but no evidence to actually back that theory.
Right.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge. Upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Sticking with the topic of low-hanging fruit and the more difficult cases in innocence projects and clinics, you know, Susan, we had a recent episode following up on the Dennis Perry case. And, you know, as we laid out, you were the lead in that case, of course, and investigated it so well. And the news since we were off the air, of course, is that Eric Spar, this alternate suspect that you brought up on the podcast, has been arrested. There was a trial, there was a mistrial. And so, you know, later this year, in a few months, there's going to be a retrial of Eric Spar. And so can you kind of take us through your experience in hearing that Eric Spar had been arrested and everything going on in that case?
Yeah, no, I saw the news on Twitter from like the GBI, like late at night. And I was like, what the actual, y'all finally doing this? Because I mean, it's been years at this point. So Eric Spar, he was, oh man. So he was someone the GIP, Georgia Innocence Project attorneys, and I were extremely interested in because of his various connections to some other witnesses. And he was, for obvious reasons, a really person of interest, let's say. But he also was never going to talk. He was also difficult to find in the first place. So the plan that GIP got and eventually worked was to get his mother to agree to give a hair sample. And so she finally did. And lo and behold, it was a, well, mitochondrial DNA match for evidence found at the crime scene, which, given everything else, is a pretty, I mean, is it enough for trial? We'll find out. But to me, I have no doubts that he was the perpetrator, based on that.
It was hair left in, glasses, stuck in a pair of glasses, right? And the glasses belonged to Eric Spar?
Well, I mean,
the features of the glasses match his glasses. Consistent with being a welder and, kind of.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a lot of reasons to think that it's a case that adds up pretty well.
Yeah.
In some respects, there are definitely some gaps there that I'm hoping the trial might be able to answer. And of course, there's like some weird turns in the case, too. Like the fact that when this does come up in court for Dennis Perry, the prosecution, even then, even knowing the DNA matches this other great suspect, they decided to fight it and tried to say that it doesn't matter if his DNA proves he's innocent. He agreed to waive all rights to an appeal in exchange for not being put to death. So therefore, that should still be enforced against him. Yeah. They lost. The court was like, no, actually, I'm not going to do that.
Right, right.
That day, Eric Spar's mother is found dead with a bag over her head.
Oh, what?
Yes.
Okay, I missed that detail.
She is found asphyxiated. But, you know, the GBI determines it was a undetermined manner. Like, maybe it wasn't, she just fell in a
undetermined
bag. Undetermined? Yeah, I don't know. And she just fell in a bag. Who's to say?
Okay.
Right. I mean,
oh, my Lord.
When I saw the police reports for it, I'm like, okay, this is not.
The day that happens, Eric Spar is still running around out there. He's out there somewhere.
And then his mom falls in a plastic bag. Yeah. And,
Come on.
So that case, they have no interest in pursuing. And I can't say that it wasn't murder, but I definitely have questions.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem like they had any interest in pursuing Spar for the Swains, the couple that were killed in the church down there. But I guess it looks like they were.
Yeah.
My read on it is the GBI actually did want to do it, but had pushback from other elements of the system. But they finally prevailed and they arrested Spar.
Wow. Yeah. And this is one of the, is it one of the almost, I mean, it's very rare in any of our cases where even if there's an exoneration that they actually reopen the case, reinvestigate, make an arrest. Has that happened in any other case?
Not for us, but for other DNA cases.
Right. Yeah. But none of our cases, I don't think
never.
Has happened.
Never.
Yeah.
Ever.
So it's rare. So I give that to them, even though the mother thing is ridiculous.
Yeah. And sticking with Georgia, I'm sure, I hope most of our listeners have listened to all three seasons and the continuing season three of Proof. But for those who haven't, season one is in Georgia. It is absolutely riveting. And so, Susan, for hopefully the few listeners who have not checked out Proof, can you tell them a bit about season one of Proof and these two wrongfully convicted men?
Well, season one was, it's based on someone I met through Joey Watkins. It was one of his friends in prison. They're both from Rome. They didn't know each other outside, but they, you know, met up in prison. And while we were working on Joey's case, he like one day put me on the phone with his buddy and he's like, hey, here's Lee, talk to him. And, at the time, I didn't really, for various reasons, I thought about him a lot. It took a couple of years to like actually find a way to cover his case. Mm. But it all started with Joey because he knew that his friend was innocent too. And Floyd County done the same thing to them. So Lee Clark and Josh Story were the co-defendants in that case. They're both teenagers at the time. What happened is really basic. Like there was never a mystery to begin with. It's one of the few cases I think we've covered on any of the shows I've done that it's not really a mystery. Like it was a tragic accident. The boys are playing Russian roulette.
Yeah.
One of them lost. And it should never have been more than that because it frankly is an obvious case what happened.
And there were two defendants convicted in this, right?
One of them was the boy playing Russian roulette with his friend in the room. And the other was not there at all, but allegedly came and shot the one boy through the window and ran away again.
Mm.
Yeah. And the worst part is the boy who died was on the phone with his girlfriend, who hears the whole thing.
Oh,
and
wow.
She hears him say, I'm playing Russian roulette in the bang.
Yeah.
So there's pretty strong evidence.
Yeah.
Like I would get why you might doubt Josh Story's story if that's all you had. Mm-hmm. But the girlfriend on the phone who doesn't know corroborates him perfectly. So.
But you managed to get two exonerations there.
Yeah.
Yes. Eventually the Floyd County prosecutors folded when it became clear that they had very many problems with their evidence and their case.
Mm.
So they are now free and trying to rebuild their lives and currently in litigation to try and get compensation, which I hope very much they get.
Yeah, that's good. And season two was where?
Manteca, California. And that's another. So poor Jake. So Jake Silva is a surviving defendant in that case. We found evidence, the missing evidence, the murder weapon, clothing for DNA testing over a year ago now.
Wow.
And for reasons that are like ridiculous and we'll get into more later, but they're just frankly absurd. The testing is being delayed and any results of those testing is being delayed for reasons that are not.
But the court has ordered testing.
All I can say is that the testing was ordered. It went in for testing over a year ago and we're still sitting here and it's not because I didn't find nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. We actually hear from the cold case team in at least the first four episodes. And there are so many times when you hear like either from them directly or things they've said to others and they come across so arrogant and they're so like sure of themselves. And like, don't you know who we are? Like they're going in guns blazing.
We're going to be on TV.
Right. We're going to be on TV. And, you know, what's interesting is that we have seen this kind of pattern with you know, like there are certain figures in other cases, like Detective Lammy in one of our cases, and like who, like the people that are brought in, right? Like these larger than life figures, detectives. It's not a cold case unit. It's just they can't get anywhere. They bring on a new guy a couple years later who comes in and it's always the same personality. It's like a very typical stereotype, like, you know, very self-assured detective who's like, my gut tells me all everything I need to know. I don't need evidence. And you see this over and over again. But here it was like manifested in an entire unit.
And the personalities, like the people involved do change. Like there's a core group and then over the years, like the people sub in, sub out, leave. So it's not always the same group, but it's very frequently Workman. That's one of the main ones. So is Madison. And I will say Detective Madison's interesting because it is a team with a lot of egos, which does not describe Madison at all. He seems kind of like an outlier compared to many of the other detectives in that group.
Is the pattern you've seen with a lot of these cases that seem like they're probably likely wrongful convictions is that they end up getting witnesses like Stacy or false confessions? Is that what they're using basically as their evidence?
Well, false confessions, yes. That's one component is false confession. We'll get into that more. That's going to be a serious issue for some of the cases. The other thing that's the same for all of them is they've got all these witnesses who said one thing when the crime happened, and then 10 years later, they talk to the cold case team and magically have a new story that fits. Like again and again and again. Like how is red flags not going off in this case, this unit does like 10, whatever cases, 14 cases in a row where it's like magically all these witnesses suddenly remember things totally different. Like that should have alerted people to the fact that things are not in the up and up. Like witnesses don't just magically change their memories entirely for good reasons.
Yeah. And we're recording here on February 13th. I don't know if you all saw the news, especially with you covering this Michigan case, Susan, of the Karen Bose case out of Michigan.
No.
Jim Tranum going back all the way to serial.
No.
Really? The lead interrogator for DC, who has now become the person who says, here's how I elicited false confessions. Yeah. In this Karen Bose case, just yesterday he testified, look, in Karen Bose's case, which is this Michigan case where she confessed, this has all the indicia of the tactics that lead to false confessions. And so, I mean, that's, I think, Susan, what was the term that they used to sort of jog their memories that you noted on the podcast?
Yeah. Waking a memory. So they call
it waking a memory. Yeah. That's not something that gives me comfort when I hear that.
I know. And Colin, like, it is frustrating to see, like, in these, it is annoying how the rules of evidence make it really hard to effectively bring this up. Like there are obviously strategies for impeaching, but like the way it plays out in court, like, so let's say you have witness Bobby. Bobby says, I saw a blue car in 1985, you know, fast forward 2005. And they say, I saw a tricycle with like a bear on it and the bear did the murder. It's harder than you'd think to effectively impeach that.
Yeah.
Like you can't just like lay the statements out to the jury. Like the statements aren't evidence. So the jury is not going to see like in black and white. Here's how I said one thing. Here's the other thing I said. It's totally different.
Yeah. And I think you kind of raised that point with Stacy, right? Where Stacy says, well, Scott confessed on a day that turns out he was in jail.
Yeah.
And then she changes it a few times. In a trial, she's just basically saying, he confessed. I don't know when it was. And there's not really a way to attack that other than to say, you know, that's not what you said before.
Yeah. Well, the prosecutor even embraces it. He's like, Stacy says he confessed. When did he confess? After the murder? A year later? Who knows? Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's how you teach the jury that this is how you have to think about this. Like, already put that aside. It's not even an issue. Did Stacy eventually get that money? Did she get the reward money?
Well, she got something.
Okay, she got something. She
did not get the $75,000. As far as I'm aware, I don't know if anyone did. It's just unclear. But she did, in fact, get money.
Okay. So how many more episodes can we expect? We're episode 4 now.
We are supposed to be 12 episodes. Mm, okay. I hope we are. We'll see. Things
Susan's
always
12
happen.
Is well, like a 15 to 20.
Things always keep popping up. And there's always so many cases here that stuff just...
Have you already started getting, because, you know, a lot of times when we go to air on anything, like you start getting leads and tips and people are like, wait a minute, I have something. Is that happening yet?
Yes, we've gotten a few. Nothing's unexpected, really. Like there's always things you hope that will come forward after you start.
Yeah.
Like, we haven't necessarily gotten that, but had a few kind of curveball things. They're like, you know, sort of like quirky little like, oh, that makes more sense now. Like, I kind of get it.
Yeah. They must hate to see you coming in Kalamazoo, though.
Sure.
I mean,
not just Susan, but your two co-hosts. And so, I mean, for listeners who haven't listened, obviously, you know what Susan brings to the table in terms of these investigations. Can you tell our listeners about your two co-hosts and their own areas of expertise?
So Jacinda and Kevin are my co-hosts, and they come from like the TV background. They're TV producers. Mm-hmm. They do, if you watch any Discovery ID, you've definitely seen their shows. Mm-hmm. Evil Lives Here is probably the most well-known one, but they've done like Two Shallow Graves, Shattered. So TV is a very different world, and this has been, I mean, it was definitely a learning curve for all of us trying to figure out how to transition from TV techniques to podcasting.
Yeah.
But this is sort of a chance to, one, do stuff that matters, like deeply, and to also have investigations that can be aired. Because like, in TV, you don't got any time for that. Like, there's no room. Like, even if you find really good, important things while working on a show, incidentally, there's no room for that to come out.
Unless they can film the defendant walking out of prison, they just can't. Mm-hmm. It just kind of doesn't work for television, unfortunately. And Don's case was kind of a one-off, but usually you do not get that kind of leeway.
No.
I want to ask a little bit. We did hear from Scott's son.
Yeah.
And I want to hear a little bit about how the family's doing now.
You know, it was a complicated family dynamic. Scott was not always a great dad and definitely not a great husband. I mean, he was an involved dad when he had the opportunity to be, but there was, even before his arrest, like there was there was drama there. There was sort of hurt feelings.
A lot of ladies in his life.
Yes. And a complicated family situation. And also dealing with a profoundly autistic son doesn't help. Yeah. I mean, any family's going to be pressured by that. So his relationship with his kids, they all have sort of a different relationship with him. But his son kind of distanced himself. They were estranged for probably about 12 years. Mm. He's not able to see his autistic son because the son can't handle the prison environment and the guards aren't understanding. So he never saw him, like, again.
Wow.
His daughter and he were still close. And his youngest son, you know, he was born right before he got arrested. So they did have a relationship, but, like, never one on the outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of season 4 of Proof, do you already have the case lined up and investigating, or are you still making decisions about what to pursue next?
No. Okay. That is tomorrow's problem. That is many months from now problem. I am
That ties in perfectly to what I want to ask, which is, are we ever going to hear about the murderous opera singer? Because I have been waiting on that for a long
time. I hope to God. I hope to God.
Please, Susan Simpson, bring us that story.
I would love that before. Yes.
That would be amazing. Yeah.
Do you remember that song, the Rats song?
Yes.
I still get it caught in my head sometimes. I'm like, why is this awful song?
I still, when I'm talking to folks, I'd be like, I got to tell you about this case. It's the craziest case. I'm waiting for Susan to do it. Okay. Well, we'll follow up. Maybe I'll follow up with you offline to ask you more about that because it's, I think, one of the craziest cases I've ever heard. But are you guys putting out seasons? Is it every year?
More or less. It's whenever.
Between babies and cats and all that stuff.
Whenever and investigations,
And, I get it. Well, Susan, thank you so much for coming back. You are welcome to come back anytime.
Great to
anytime
be back.
Yes. I mean, honestly, anytime you want to come back. In fact, for our listeners who were wondering, like when we did our little relaunch and we started with those 6 episodes for Adnan, I was like, Susan, you want to do a couple of episodes? You got anything to say about Adnan? So if there's anything you wanted to say then, you didn't get a chance. And I think it was just very kind of, the timing was tight
Time. No, it was not ideal timing.
Not ideal timing.
With the baby.
but right, that's right. The little one was a lot younger then. Very little then, yes. But you are welcome to come back and be like, I have something to say to add to like what you guys said in those 6 episodes. If you ever get a chance to listen to those.
I mean, I've got a lot to say. Not all of it's like appropriate to air. Mostly curse words.
You know, I know you have a lot of thoughts, but that would be fun to have you back to be like, these are my closing thoughts on Adnan Syed.
Well, I'm glad that he's out. So at least, he's home.
He is. Have you gotten a chance to meet him on the outside than the day? Oh, my God. Okay, we're making that happen. It has been a hairy couple of years. Obviously, last March is when he was finally, was it last March or April when he was finally resentenced? And it's a little kind of sort of over, but we'll make that happen. So, Susan, before we head out for this week, can you please tell folks again where to find your podcast, where to find you, how to contact you if they have stuff to talk to you about?
You can find us at proofcrimepod.com or if you look on Spotify or Apple or any other places, Proof, a True Crime Podcast. And you can find me at Twitter, sort of, not there anymore, hardly, too, or on Instagram and maybe Facebook once in a while. But listen to the show. This one's going places that I would definitely never have guessed before we started. And it is a wild ride.
Great. Thank you so much, Susan. And I cannot wait to hear the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Congratulations on your success. It's amazing. Great work. All right, guys. Thanks so much. Thanks, listeners.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money. But nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com groups/toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.